From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen. Monday of this week marked the end of the annual Islamic observance of Ramadan. During this month, members of the Muslim faith fast during daylight hours and in doing so observe one of the five pillars of Islam. Which begs the question, what are the five pillars of Islam? The Bluegrass State is home for many Muslims, and on today's Eastern Standard, we will discuss the history, tenets, and misconceptions of Islam. We would like to hear from you, and we welcome your comments and questions for our guests, maybe even your personal stories. Are you a member of the Muslim faith and want to share your story and experience living in the Bluegrass State? Are you someone who wants to learn more about Islam? That number is 800-621-8890. If you call now, it'll be a little while before we get you on the air, but you're welcome to do so. Or you can wait for 15 or 20 minutes, and we'll make sure that we remind you of that phone number. You can email your questions, comments, or stories now to WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com, or post your comments and questions on Facebook, or send us a tweet at WEKUEST. And let me introduce our guests who are with us today. First up in the studio is Dr. Richard Cahill, who earned his Ph.D. in history at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He lived in Egypt for 7 years, where he directed the Middle East Studies program. That program for the University of California, Dr.
No,
Cahill?
It was a privately owned program.
Oh, okay. University Studies program, or the Middle East Studies program. Dr. Cahill has been at Berea College since 2005, where he is Director of International Education and an Associate Professor of History. And Dr. Cahill teaches courses on Islam as well as the history of the Middle East and the Arab-Israeli conflict. Dr. Richard Cahill, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
On the line today is also Professor Ihsan Bagby. In addition to his position as a Professor of Islamic Studies at the University of Kentucky, Dr. Bagby sits on the board of Masjid Bilal. I'll ask you to correct me if I mispronounce a word at some point, Dr. Bagby.
Sounds pretty good, John.
Okay, very. Thank you. And Masjid Bilal is one of three mosques in Lexington. His research centers on the American Muslim community with a focus on American mosques in particular. Dr. Bagby is a convert who embraced the religion in 1969 and has lived in Kentucky since 2002. Dr. Ihsan Bagby, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Let's start with Dr. Richard Cahill. A few weeks ago, we did a program on ISIS in Iraq, and Dr. Cahill contacted us and said, if you'd like to do a little bit more on the details and the specifics of the Muslim religion or Islam, he offered to make himself available, and we are grateful for that. And that is our focus today. So rather than talking politics in the Middle East, we want to talk about religion. Talk about the basics of this religion. And I believe I'm correct in understanding that Islam is the second largest religion on this planet today, and I guess one of the largest growing religions.
That is correct.
Dr. Cahill, let's talk briefly, and of course we will ask Professor Bagby to chime in at any point. Talk about the history of Islam, its roots. That's a very old religion, I guess second in age to Christianity among the major faiths as well.
Right. So Islam dates back to the 7th century with the career of the Prophet Muhammad. The Muslim community and the Islamic tradition views Muhammad as standing in the line of monotheistic religions, so very much in the line of Abraham and the Jewish faith and the Christian faith, and Muhammad is another of the prophets. Islam recognizes the former prophets and views Muhammad as the seal of the prophets, and Muhammad lived from 570 until 632, and the last 22 or 23 years of his life was when the Quran, the holy book of Islam, was revealed to him. And since I teach undergraduates at Berea College, most of whom come from Christian backgrounds or nominally Christian backgrounds, I often compare things to what their experience might be. And I like to say that to think of the Quran in the Muslim religion is, it kind of has the role in some ways that Jesus has in the Christian religion, as opposed to, say, the Prophet Muhammad being the equivalent of Jesus, okay? Because the Quran is this Word of God that comes down and becomes incarnate, if you will, becomes written down eventually. And so the Quran, in that regard, is like the New Testament says, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us and so forth. Jesus, you know, is God incarnate, comes down. So the Quran kind of takes on that. It's not God, of course, but it's the Holy Speech which comes down. And the Quran is so central to Islam, incredibly central.
Similar to the New Testament for Christians?
Yes. Similar in some ways, but different in other ways. You mentioned in the introduction that I lived in Egypt, which I did for 7 years, traveled also around the Middle East. So my experience in Muslim countries that are predominantly Muslim has been in the Middle East. And of course, there are large Muslim populations other places in the world. So my experience in Muslim communities is shaped by that. But there I witnessed something different about the way the Quran functions in society as compared to the way the Bible functions in society, in this society anyway. And that is the Quran is used as a protection, almost like a talisman. So a shop that's closed at night would set an open Quran in the window of the shop, right behind the locked door. So if a thief were to look in, he might be reminded not to break in. Taxi drivers will have chanting Quran recitation over their speakers, you know, as they're driving. There'll be little Qurans on the dashboard. And there are certain verses of the Quran which are believed to be very protective. And so that's one function that the Quran has that is not very analogous to most ways that Christians in this society would view the Bible.
At the center of many people's lives in such a way that they are constantly reminded of their beliefs and of their tradition?
Yes. At the same time, at least in evangelical and since Vatican II Catholic circles, Christians are pretty familiar with the text of the Bible and the meaning and the, you know, like they study, you have Bible studies when you're Christians, right? Historically, Muslims, just the general population, hasn't studied the Quran in that same way. Of course, you could say the same thing about Christianity 1,000 years ago before the Protestant Reformation and so forth. But Muslim traditionally would hear recited it before the learned scholars of Islam to actually study the text. The general population would just hear it recited because it's very poetic. The whole Quran is very poetic.
Dr. Ihsan Bagby, let's pick up with you here. As Dr. Cahill says, Islam is a religion within the Abrahamic tradition. Explain that to me. And how is Islam, you know, at what point does Judaism and Islam differ? Is there a point at which they follow the same track, as it were, in the Hebrew Bible, or what Christians would know as the Old Testament? Dr. Bagby?
I'm sorry, you're breaking up. Unfortunately, I don't know what's wrong.
Oh, sorry. Sorry to hear that. Can you hear me clearly now?
Yeah, I can hear you, but you're going in and out. Sorry.
I'll tell you, let me see if we can get a question through, and then if we get a, you sound great. So let's get a question, get you on the air here for a few moments, and then we will disconnect and call back and see if we can get a better connection.
Okay.
The divisions or the separation, let's talk about actually the similarities between Judaism and Islam. At what point do those two religions diverge and go different paths? Okay, so I guess we did lose the connection, and we're going to call back. Sorry about that. And we are going through some changes on the campus with a new telephone system, so we thought everything was in order, but we'll get Dr. Bagby back on the line. I'll just pick that up with you, Dr.
Okay.
Richard Cahill.
Well, in Islam, traditional Islam holds that there are four heavenly books of revelation. So the Torah of Moses, which is the first five books of the Old Testament, or the Hebrew Bible, the Psalms of David, the Gospel of Jesus, and the Quran. These are the four heavenly books, according to Islam. So Islam...
So the Gospel of Jesus is revered and recognized.
Yes, the Gospel of Jesus. And if you're familiar with the New Testament, we have no gospel of Jesus per se. We have a gospel according, the gospel of Jesus according to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and so forth. So the Muslim Islamic tradition has these four heavenly books and recognizes them as being authoritative, coming from God. Where they differ from the Quran, Muslims believe that those earlier books must have been corrupted or changed. This is most important when it comes to the gospel. The gospel of Jesus, of course, the accounts that we have in the New Testament have, you know, the crucifixion, have Jesus being the Son of God, dying for our sins and all this. Well, that differs with Islam and the Quran. So the Quran supersedes the earlier revelations where they conflict. But you find the same prophets in the Quran, mention of the prophets that you find in the Hebrew Bible. And so these are the four heavenly books in Islam.
And we may not have time to get this answer complete before taking a station break, but okay, so the Quran was a revelation to Muhammad, and Muhammad essentially, it was only his hands involved in physically writing the Quran. Is that correct?
Well, not writing it. Okay, and here are the traditions.
Getting it into writing. So were there, did it pass through other hands?
Okay, so this is the way.
Because you know where I'm going in terms of the Hebrew
and the Christian
scriptures. All of those have many, many, many authors, and they went through many hands. And
the
opportunities for potential corruption.
Right.
Sounds. I would say there are a lot of them.
Right. Yeah. Well, the Muslim tradition holds that Muhammad was illiterate. Okay. He was raised illiterate. He was a very spiritual person. He would go and meditate. He was fortunate to marry a rich widow, which gave him the time to meditate. And he was meditating in a cave in the month of Ramadan, which is why Ramadan is important. It's because the first time the Quran, the first revelation came during that month. So Ramadan is important. So from that first revelation, when God told Muhammad, write or recite, and Muhammad said, I can't recite. I don't know how, you know, I can't read. Read. I can't read. Read. I can't read. Third time, what shall I recite? And then this revelation, recite in the name of God, who taught man what he didn't know, taught him by the pen, and so forth. And so over the years, Muhammad gets this oral, powerful, rhyming, rhythmic Arabic poetry, and he recites it to people.
Let's stop right there because we do need to take a short station break, and we'll come back to Dr. Richard Cahill, and hopefully we're going to get back to Dr. Isan Bagby of the University of Kentucky. We had a problem with our telephone connection, but we hopefully are restoring that connection now. 800-621-8890 is the number you are welcome to call if you have a question, a comment, or a story as we talk about the basics of Islam. Send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. That phone number again, 800-621-8890. This is Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm John Hingsbergen with, in the studio, Dr. Richard Cahill of Berea College. He is the Director of International Education and Associate Professor of History there. And on the phone line, Dr. Isan Bagby. Are you back, Dr. Bagby?
I am back. Hopefully the connection is good.
If you can hear me, and if you have difficulty, let us know, and we'll, again, reconnect. But Dr. Bagby is a professor of Islamic studies at the University of Kentucky and sits on the board of Masjid Bilal, one of three mosques in Lexington. And Dr. Bagby, we'll come back to you in just a moment. Let me let Dr. Cahill finish. He was telling us how the Quran came to be. The Prophet Muhammad, God spoke to Muhammad, said, read. Muhammad says, I cannot read. God says, write. I cannot write. Take it from there.
Okay. So Muhammad receives these revelations, and in some of the traditions, it's actually the angel Gabriel that's transmitting the message. So it's not like he's hearing God's physical voice. But in any case, he receives revelations over the course of the rest of his life. These are recited. They're memorized by him. They're memorized by his followers, because very early on, as he shares this powerful poetry that seems just it's just miraculous language. People convert to Islam and to the message that there's just one God. He's living in a polytheistic environment and so forth. And so over the course of these 22 years or 23 years, all these revelations are memorized by the community. Now, some of the tradition says that parts of them were written down. the standard widely held belief among Muslims and Muslim scholars historically is that Muhammad didn't edit or physically write anything. He had people that were writing near him. He would review stuff perhaps, but it's not like he had the complete text or book in front of him to review before he passed away. After his death, then we can talk about, you know, subsequent history, but the third leader of the community, Uthman, collected the Quran, and actually the collection happened earlier, but his collection, he said, this is going to be the authoritative collection, and had all of the versions destroyed and had his version go out throughout the Muslim empire. And so that's why you don't have textual variants. You don't have, you know, like New Testament studies. It's very much, you have this one Arabic text the Muslims have been using since the 7th century. It's the same language. It's not translated. It's pure Quranic Arabic. That's it.
So Dr. Ihsan Bagby, hopefully we have a decent connection here, but can you fill us, to take it from here then, in terms of the origins of the Quran and similarities to Jewish Bible, the Old Testament, as Christians would refer to it, and Christianity. You would say, would you agree with Dr. Cahill, that there's a tremendous amount of confidence that the wording of the Quran has been transmitted over the years in a pretty exact form over the years?
Yes. I think you could say there's almost a consensus among scholars, Western scholars in particular, that what is transmitted as the Quran came from the mouth of Muhammad. Of course, whether it came from God is a question of belief, but there's little debate about that. And that's why the critical studies that are, you know, part of Christian scholarship of the New Testament and the Old Testament does not exist really in the Quran, because almost everybody agrees it comes from one source, being Muhammad. And it is, the Quran is the centerpiece of Islam, along with the sayings and example of Muhammad. Those are the two things that constitute the authoritative sources of Islam, the Quran, and the sayings and actions of the normative actions of Muhammad. And that is one of the reasons why Islam as a religion has not really changed much in terms of its ritual, because of this focus on these clear, accepted, authoritative sources of Islam.
We'll come back at some point here in a few minutes to the concept of Islamic fundamentalism, which is something we've heard tossed around quite a bit in the last few decades here in the U.S. But Dr. Bagby, where would, say, a Jewish listener to today's program say, yes, I believe the same thing? Where would Islam and Judaism agree? Are there some elements that are in total agreement, and as part of the line of the as an Abrahamic religion, that you're on the same track?
Yes, as stated before, that Muhammad himself saw Islam as simply a continuation of the monotheistic revolution, the monotheistic religion started by Abraham, really. And so the similarities far outnumber the differences. Sometimes I use the metaphor of a portrait by three different artists of the same landscape, let's say, and you look at the three pictures and you can see very clearly it's the picture of a portrait of the same thing. You know, you see the farmhouse or whatever, but they all have different textures, different shades of color. To me, that's the relationship between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. The same fundamental worldview, but with different hues, different colors. But the similarities far outweigh the differences.
Your comments sound similar to others that I've spoken with over the years. It sounds like members of the Islamic faith feel the similarities are great, but Dr. Cahill, would you not agree that most members of the practicing Jewish members of the religion or Christians would maybe differ in that regard? The Quran seems very, at least as the way I've understood it, seems to be very foreign or very different to those of us in the Judeo-Christian line.
Right. I mean, like Dr. Begbie said, the main thing is this monotheistic tradition. These are the three great monotheistic religions. So the fact that there's just one God, that's something obviously that the Jewish religion and the Muslim or the Islamic religion share, and that's paramount, huge. As I said before, the Muslims recognize the Torah. They recognize the Psalms of David, and in so doing, they basically accept most of Judaism. It's very, I think, interesting when you look at the three side by side, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. Judaism and Islam are religions that really kind of historically have taught a way of life. They're legal traditions. They have a huge emphasis on law and how to live rightly. You know, bar mitzvah, Jewish kids learning all the rules in the Torah and so forth. And Islam is a lot historically about living rightly, following this example of Muhammad according to Islamic law. Islamic law not as a boxed set of law, physical laws, but as a school of thought. So in that regard, Christianity is the odd man out in that Christianity is almost a revolt against that legal tradition of Judaism. So that, I think, is a very interesting thing. You have the two, Islam and Judaism, being very legally oriented and Christianity not.
Let me open the lines, let our listeners know you can get on board. If you have a question, a comment, maybe even a personal story of an experience of the Islamic religion, 800-621-8890. Please feel free to get on the line, and we will get you on the air sometime soon, hopefully. 800-621-8890. You can send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at WEKUEST. And if you can post a question or a brief comment in 140 characters, it'll pop right up here. I'm looking at the Twitter feed right here. So if you write to us at WEKUEST, we can get your comment on the air as well. That phone number again, though, we'd love to hear your voice if you'd like to talk to us, 800-621-8890. Let's go back to Dr. Ihsan Begbie.
And John, if I could just add on to what Dr. Cahill said.
Absolutely.
I don't know if the word legal can be misunderstood. I mean, Islam and Judaism focuses on practice, how to please God, how to live a life of submission, surrender to God. And Christianity focuses mainly on belief. But, you know, all three of them have the same idea that you have to believe in the one God, and you have to live accordingly. But there are different focuses. Islam and Judaism, their main focus is on practice. Mm-hmm.
Do Muslims believe, Dr. Begbie, that they're going to see Christians and Jews in heaven?
Yes. There are very clear verses in Quran that say that people who are Christian, those who are Jew, those who are Sabian, and nobody knows exactly who the Sabians are, and those who are Muslim, those who believe that if they believe in the one God and they do good deeds, that they have no fear, they will be in heaven. Now, there's a lot of details about that, but Muslim theology agrees that heaven is composed of many different religions, different people, including Christians and Jews, and hell will include Muslims also, Muslims who do not live a righteous life.
So the option exists for both directions for members of all faiths.
That's right.
Dr. Begbie, let me ask you this. We referred to earlier at the very beginning of the show to the five pillars of Islam. Can you talk about those five pillars of Islam?
Well, this shows, again, the emphasis on practice because the five pillars are the five obligatory acts that a Muslim must do. The first is to proclaim publicly that they believe in the one God, Allah. And Allah is the Arabic word for God. It
It is the same one God of the Old Testament and New Testament. Christians, Arab-speaking Christians, Arab-speaking Jews use the same word, Allah, to refer to God. So the first pillar is to proclaim publicly belief in the one God and Muhammad as a messenger of God. The second pillar is prayer. A Muslim is supposed to pray five times a day, morning, noon, mid-afternoon, sunset, and evening, as a way of returning to God, refocusing oneself on this ideal of living a life of surrender to God. Then the third pillar is fasting. We just finished the month of fasting, Ramadan. And then the fourth pillar is zakah, or charity. A Muslim must give 2.5% of accumulated wealth that goes to the poor. And then finally, there's pilgrimage. At least once in a lifetime, if one is able to make the pilgrimage to Mecca, to the Kaaba, which is now in Saudi Arabia.
Very interesting. This is, again, I mentioned to Dr. Cahill during the station break, I'm learning a lot about Islam on today's program. We hope our listeners are learning, and we invite you to get on the line. I know there's at least one caller waiting on the line. We'd be glad to get you on. I believe we have one open at 800-621-8890. Send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. I want to get a few more questions answered before we turn to the telephones and to our listeners, and then kind of, you know, turn the listeners loose in terms of getting some of these answers to questions that folks may have. But
John, could
sure,
I just add one thing that might be missed? I mean, Islam is a very spiritual way of life. I mean, these five pillars should be seen as a way that a person seeks relationship to God. This is often missed by those who look on the outside to Islam. On the inside, amongst, you know, many, many Muslims, this striving for God consciousness, relationship to God, is so central to the Islamic experience.
And Dr. Bagby, tell us about the various sects of the Islamic faith. As in world events today, there are people labeled as Islamic fundamentalists, people who are radical, supposedly, in their interpretation of the Quran and their belief that perhaps, you know, others are their enemy or not co-believers with them. I mean, where does all of this line up? Let's spell out for us the basics in terms of the sects. I know Sunni and Shiite are a couple that we've heard of.
Well, there are two basic sects in Islam, Sunni and Shiite, as you said. The whole idea of like ISIS and Al-Qaeda and others, I mean, those are not, we would not think of them as sects. These are trends within the Muslim community of extremists, kind of more middle-of-the-road people, and then progressive. So those are just trends within the Muslim community. They do not constitute sects as such. Historically, the two major sects are the mainstream group, what is called Sunni group. Maybe 85%, 90% of all Muslims are Sunni. And then the Shiite group is the major other sect within Islam. However, the differences between the Sunni and Shiite theologically are less than the differences, to say, between Catholics and Protestants, even Southern Baptists and Methodists, probably, because both of them recognize one another as Muslim, and most would agree that a Shiite can perform the religious functions of Sunnis, and Sunnis can lead Shiites. Here in Lexington, you know, we have Shiites and Sunnis praying together, working together in the same mosque, and this is not uncommon in America. Unfortunately, the relationship between Sunnis and Shiites has been exasperated, in the last few decades.
What in the Islamic faith has caused some people to move to violence or hatred, disrespect for others in the name of that religion, in the name of the Prophet Muhammad?
Well, that's a big question. Simply, as I could put it, Islam and the Muslim world is transitioning from its classical period in which it was the dominant civilization of the world to a post-colonial period when it has been basically defeated, subjugated through the era of colonialism. And Islam is trying to and the Muslim world is trying to get back on its feet, reestablish itself, redefine itself, and shake off this sense of subjugation to the West. I mean, our listeners must realize that the West dominated, ruled the Muslim world for some time, and the Muslim world is basically trying to right itself, redefine itself in this new modern age. And there's a lot of anger, and some of that anger is expressed in extremism. So if you listen to some of the complaints of the Osama bin Ladens of the world about Palestine, about Kashmir, Chechnya, and all that, most Muslims would agree that these are sore spots for Muslims.
Okay, Dr. Bagley, we need to take a short break here. We're going to come right back to you. And we want to invite our listeners to get on board, 800-621-8890. We're talking the basics of Islam on this week's Eastern Standard on WEKU. It's Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsbergen. Our guests on the telephone line, Professor Ihsan Bagby of the University of Kentucky, and in the studio, we have Dr. Richard Cahill of Berea College. We're talking about Islam, and we want to get to the phones. We want to get to our listeners in just a few moments. I'll remind you of the phone number if you'd like to get on the line, 800-621-8890. Dr. Bagby, I had to cut you off because we try to follow the clock on our station breaks and so forth. But talking about the roots, the anger, the frustration, what that have created problems for many people in terms of their relationships among Muslims and others.
Well, I was just saying that there are extremists who have taken the complaints of Muslims about the subjugation, domination by the West, and have chosen a path of extremism, both in certain beliefs, but also in terms of practices that justify terrorism, killing of innocent people, which is not justified in any of the classical views of Islam, classical opinions about Islam. The killing of innocent people is strictly forbidden. But they have taken this position to justify their hope of kind of overthrowing the domination of the West, a very misplaced idea. But there are others who have, tried to stake out a middle ground in terms of relationship to the West, relationship to the modern world, and try to find and define an Islam that is true to its roots, but at the same time is compatible. It lives very comfortably in the modern world. And there are those who basically have kind of pushed away Islam as being old, no longer relevant, and outdated, old-fashioned. And so within the Muslim world, there are currents and trends very much alive as to how to define Islam. And we're definitely in this transition period in of Muslims themselves coming to a consensus as to what is this Islam and this new era.
Very helpful, Dr. Bagby. Thank you so much for that answer. Let's go ahead and talk to listeners. Let's get a caller on the line, Jacob from Lexington. Jacob, thank you for waiting, being patient with us. Go right ahead with your question for our guests.
Hey, coming from a Christian background, I have a little bit of bias and don't know exactly all the intricacies of Islam. But I heard someone that had switched over from Christianity to Islam say that Islam did hold to the belief that Jesus was God and that he was, you know, held the key to salvation. Also, I was wondering how they view the Bible as far as its inerrancy, if you could speak on that.
Let me ask Dr. Cahill first, and then, of course, we want to get Dr. Bagby's response to that question. Thank you so much for calling, Jacob. The phone number, by the way, 800-621-8890.
So if I understood Jacob correctly, he heard that in Islam they teach that Jesus is God. That is incorrect. Islam teaches that Jesus was a prophet, a great prophet, but just a human. And that point ties into his second question about the inerrancy of Scripture. As I mentioned earlier, the Quran, where the Quran and the Bible, basically the New Testament, the Gospel, disagree, the Quran supersedes it. And so anything that refers to Jesus being crucified or being raised from the dead or being the Son of God, the Muslim tradition would hold that that is incorrect. It's been corrupted by the early church or something, you know, that's not really what the prophet Jesus had in mind, and his followers corrupted that in later times.
And Dr. Bagby, you are yourself a convert to Islam, so you're in a great position to respond to this question from our listener's point of view.
Yes, I was raised a Christian, and a Muslim must believe in Jesus and must believe that you cannot be a Muslim and not believe in Jesus Christ. I myself felt the transition was fairly easy because there was no need to drop belief in Jesus. The ideal of Jesus is this loving person who sacrificed everything so that humans might see have a better understanding of this all-loving God.
But that belief in Jesus that Islam or Muslims would hold is not in Jesus as God, but is in Jesus as a prophet, and would Muhammad supersede?
As a Messiah, too.
And Messiah.
As a Messiah.
As a Messiah.
Yes.
Okay.
Muslims' classical view is that Jesus did ascend to heaven, did not die, and was resurrected, but that he ascended to heaven, and he will be the Messiah. He will be the one who will return to earth and be the harbinger of the last day.
But
and that's what the Christ means. So Muslims must believe in Jesus as the Christ.
When the Quran supersedes, though, Christian and Jewish scriptures, Hebrew scriptures, that does that not place Muhammad at a higher level than Jesus?
No, the Quran itself says, do not make distinctions between the prophets. It just means that Muhammad came after Jesus. The whole rationale for why prophets is that God wants to communicate to humans his message of how to live a God-centered life, and that when followers of a prophet forget, interpolate, you know, the message of that prophet, another prophet is necessary. So Muhammad came after Jesus, not because of anything Jesus did, but the fact that Christians distorted his message, one of the main distortions being this idea of Trinity, of raising Jesus to the level of divinity, level of a Godhead, Jesus as God. And so another prophet was necessary. It does not mean that Muhammad is superior to Jesus. It's just that historically he came to correct, to bring people back to the pristine message of monotheism.
Okay, this is Eastern Standard, and this is an interactive show. We do want to hear from listeners. We have a tweet. We'd like to get another listener on the phone. You're welcome to give us a call at 800-621-8890. You can post on the WEKU Facebook page, and also you can send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. The Twitter address at WEKUEST, and the phone number again, 800-621-8890. Let me acknowledge a series of tweets from Ahmed, who says, Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world, according to United Nations statistics. He says, between 1989 and 1998, the Islamic population grew by more than 100%. And he says, I'm a student at EKU, and EKU allows Muslims to pray on campus. He says, that is awesome. People in Kentucky respect Islam and religion. Dr. Bagby, Dr. Cahill, your response to Ahmed.
Well, yeah, it is definitely a very fast-growing religion. But if actually I'd like to come back to something Dr. Bagby just said in terms of Prophet, and this may be a minor thing. My experience has been with Muslims in the Middle East, and again, this is just limited to my personal experience. And traditionally, you know, Muhammad is viewed as the seal. He's called the seal of the prophets. And my impression has been with most Muslims I've met is that they view Muhammad as being the kind of the ultimate prophet. So I kind of want to come back to the point that Dr. Bagby was making about, you know, Jesus and all prophets are equal. It seems to me that most Muslims I've met and talked to feel that Muhammad is the best prophet, the superior, you know.
That would be the reason one would choose to be a practitioner of Islam rather than, say, with Christianity.
That's just the way that Muslims perceive it and the way it's been taught. I mean, certainly the title, the seal of the prophet, Muhammad is believed to have this mark between his shoulder blades that was the sign of the seal of the prophet. And what Dr. Bagby was referring to about the traditions of how Muhammad lived and talked and all these things, these are codified for the Sunni in four major collections of oral traditions that eventually get written down called the Hadith. There are lots of things in there in the Hadith that point to Muhammad as being awesome, you know, superior.
Dr. Bagby?
Well, I mean, yes and no. It's a fine point theologically. Again, the Quran makes very clear, do not distinguish the prophets. You have to accept them all. But it also says that God gave certain favors to certain prophets over the other. Moses spoke directly to God. Abraham was the friend of God. And I would agree with Dr. Cahill that probably the majority of Muslims do view Muhammad as, in terms of his life, in terms of his character, as being the best of humanity.
But not necessarily in theology. It's a matter of practice. It's a matter of personal belief.
Yeah, it's how to accept both, at least from the position of most Muslims, of not to make distinction, not to put down any prophet, but at the same time to believe that Muhammad was the best of creation.
Let me mention another tweet that we've received from Jonathan. Jonathan says he mentioned Jesus in the end times. I'm not sure which one of you mentioned Jesus in the end times, but he asks, do they, meaning Islam, have the book of Revelations or their own version of the end times? Dr. Bagby?
No, there is no book as such. There are certain sayings of Muhammad about the end of time, the signs of the end of time. But the consensus of all Muslims is that Jesus will return at the end of time and serve as that Messiah to destroy the forces of evil and bring about a period of peace, very similar to the belief in Christianity, without a lot of details. And also, there's very, very few millenarian movements in Islam. In other words, movements that really focus on the exact time of the end of the world, because very much part of mainstream belief is that you cannot determine the end of the world, the end of time, and therefore Muslims do not concentrate on it. The point is to be prepared for it, but not to think that you can play God in knowing when the end of the world will come.
We'd be glad to get another caller on the air if someone would like to join in. We have a few minutes remaining in this week's Eastern Standard, 800-621-8890. That's 800-621-8890. Actually, we do have Frank from Lexington on the line. Frank, go right ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, John. I have a question for the good Dr. Bagby. It's something that really has been on my mind. I have read the Quran. I am a Christian. Yes, I agree with him that in pure form, it does work. There is no question. But what I can't understand is this. I don't understand, and if you could comment on this, why is it that the Western media, as he put it, which I agree, portrays this entire situation in a very distorted way? You know, there's this fear and loathing and, you know, these extremists that, quote unquote, that's always out here, you know, a complete threat, you know, an ongoing threat. I don't understand. Can you comment on the Western media and why things are being portrayed the way they're being portrayed? Is it political?
That's an excellent question, Frank. Excellent.
Well, the media focuses on what is sensational. It does not focus on those millions of Muslims who are trying to live good lives within, you know, a understanding of a peaceful religion that hopes to have good relations with everybody, and at the same time be faithful to their tradition. And we should recognize that. I mean, that's kind of how the media functions. We should not be fooled by that, by thinking that the actions of ISIS and Qaeda are somehow typical of Muslims. They are atypical of the total Muslim population. And you would hope that readers would understand that and be open-minded to a bigger picture of the phenomena of Islam.
Okay, Frank, thank you again for that question. We have just a few minutes remaining in this morning's program, and I want to ask this question first of Dr. Cahill and then to Dr. Bagby. Muslims in Kentucky, how well are Muslims accepted in Kentucky? Dr. Cahill, you're teaching about the Islamic faith. You have students at Berea College. How do they react to hearing about Islam in a state, in an area where Christianity is pretty dominant?
Right. Well, Berea College is rather unique, as your listeners may know. It offers a full tuition scholarship to every student who goes there, and they work for their room and board. And we do the same type of thing for students internationally. So we have a great number of international students applying, and we have a wide variety of people on campus, including Muslim students, both domestic and international students. And my sense is that in Berea, the students feel welcomed, and they engage with other students. And, you know, I have never heard of any harassment from within the college community. Interestingly, a couple of years ago, an Indian student was wearing a scarf over her head. She wasn't Muslim. She just was wearing a scarf because she was cold in the winter, and somebody drove down the street in Berea and yelled, you know, something at her, thinking she was a Muslim, and then she... feisty person.
You mean a negative comment?
Yes. Explicative, something Muslim, you know. And she wrote back, she yelled back that she's not Muslim and F you too or something like that, you know.
Okay.
But the tweet you just received from Ahmad, you know, he's happy to be at EKU and they can pray on campus and they can do the same in Berea.
Dr. Bagby, we have a minute for you. How are you feeling the perceptions of Islam in Kentucky? Do you feel like Muslims are welcome and respected in Kentucky?
Oh, yes. I mean, the relationship between Muslims and the rest of the Kentucky Commonwealth had been very good. Little incidents, just as Dr. Cahill mentioned, especially after 9/11, little incidents, but no major incidents, thank God. And overall, Muslims have been well accepted. We have mosques throughout Kentucky, from Prestonsburg to Paducah. We have three mosques in Lexington. I think about 12 mosques in Louisville. E-Town, they're spread out throughout the Commonwealth. At our Eid prayers, the prayers at the end of Ramadan here in Lexington, we probably had a little under 2,000 people. So it's a good-sized community and definitely growing, no question.
Excellent.
About it. Overall, the Muslim population in America is growing by leaps and bounds.
Dr. Ihsan Bagbi of the University of Kentucky. Dr. Bagbi is the professor of Islamic studies and a member on the board of Masjid Bilal, one of the three mosques in Lexington. Thank you for being with us today. And also Dr. Richard Cahill, he is the director of Middle East studies and associate professor at Berea College. Thank you both for being part of this week's Eastern Standard. Very informative. Our associate producer for the show is Richard Turner. Our technical director is Joni Franklin. On the phones, it's been Julie Tennell. We remind you the show will be available as a podcast, and actually later this afternoon, the audio will be online and available for a podcast. Thanks for joining us for Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm John Hingsburg.